Welcome to the program. I am Sally Coburn, and it is great to be with you on this somewhat overcast afternoon. But nevertheless, still, it's a great day to listen to the radio. Whatever you're doing, happy to be with you in the background or in the foreground. If you'd like to, you know, shake your fist at the radio, well, give us a call. 96900693 is the number. If you disagree with me, I'd love to hear from you. Now, as I said, we are here till six. And can I just say, I am reeling from the draconian suggestion that I read in the paper today about a former Labor federal minister that thinks that we should only allow people on the dole if they agree not to reproduce. Now, he wants to mandate contraception for these people. Hang on, contraception isn't even free in this country. So let's start with education. And is this Australia 2014, almost 2015, or is this Germany 1944? Come on. Now, we're going to be speaking to him later, but I'd love your thoughts on that one. Is this the right way to save money? While we're on relationships, I read in the paper today about another celebrity divorce, another celebrity blaming the other person. Well, you know, I speak to a lot of people who are in these sort of situations, and I know that, you know, you feel really angry when your partner has cheated on you. But is the third party the real problem? Are we focusing on the right thing, or is the affair a symptom of a relationship that's in trouble? Love to hear from you, especially if you've been the other person. 96900693, did you cop it? And was it justified? And why don't people take responsibility for having affairs in relationships? We'll also be talking to an oceanographer. We saw that there was some thought today that an oil slick may have been related to the QZ8501 flight, but it's now been said that it isn't. But we're going to speak to an oceanographer about an update on when, where, or indeed if we might expect to actually see some evidence of the outcome of that flight. Also, there's a new craze on the internet that's a DIY tattoo, and it's in the US. I'd like to know if you've heard of it coming here. Have you heard of anyone you know buying a DIY tattoo kit off the internet? Because I think it's very important, and of course there are dangers associated with that. So I'd love to hear from you. 96900693 or 131332. Also, blokes, this one's for you. Now, are you afraid to buck the system? I talk about the work, the office fashion system. That is, you know, when you think about it, women, we throw away our crinolines, we throw away all those things, and we wear sort of kind of whatever, but you guys are still wearing a suit and tie to work. Why? Why is that not moved on from there? Love to hear from you about your thoughts about why men still wear ties. 96900693. Well, it's one way to tell which politician is on which side, I suppose, but anyway. But first, now, there's a new campaign, and look, I love public health campaigns. You know I love public health campaigns. But this one's really directed towards GPs to get stuck into you more about your smoking. And on the line is Dr. Josie Sammers. She's a consultant for the GP Liaison Unit at the Alfred Hospital. Josie, tell us a little about this campaign.
Well, Sally, it's aimed not just at GPs, but at all health professionals to keep the conversation or start the conversation with their patients whenever they come into contact with them about giving up smoking. Mm. I think we've got to a stage where we think that everybody knows the risks of smoking to their health and that people will automatically try and give up if they can. So I think that we may have become a little complacent and not always asking people if they would like some help in giving up smoking.
Josie, is it complacency? I know in my practice, and I'd be interested if you find the same thing. I mean, if I keep ramming it down my patients' throats, they're just going to go, Sally, I'm not going to come back and see you if you keep doing this. They say, I am going to make my own decision. I know the ins and outs, and can you just get off my back? Do we risk alienating people?
I think that's a very important point. I think that's why many, many doctors maybe don't always ask, because we are really mindful of that very important relationship we have with our patients, and we don't want to be seen to be nagging. Mm. But on the other hand, there's a very interesting study that showed that a person who goes to the doctor and isn't asked about their smoking is less likely to try and quit than someone who didn't go to the doctor at all.
But what if you've gone to the doctor because, you know, you've got appendicitis? What if you go to the doctor because, well, I suppose appendicitis, you're going to have an operation. But, you know, it might seem a bit inappropriate when I'm counselling a patient about, you know, their feelings of suicidalness to suddenly say, oh, by the way, could you just stop smoking? I mean, isn't there a time and a place?
I think there is a time and a place. But I think it's always up to the doctor's discretion, but I think we need to be mindful of bringing up the conversation as often as we possibly can. And I think particularly in hospital as well, for hospital health professionals, it's a matter of people coming into hospital, it's often a really great opportunity for people to want to change, and they're in a situation where they know that they're at risk and it might be a good impetus to give up smoking
but
at that point.
Josie, aren't we at risk? And I mean, this is sort of harping on a little bit what I had yesterday, which is, when do we start to say to the general public, you have to take responsibility for your own health? We're happy to tell you what the risks are, but it's your job. Because don't we risk them saying, ah, oh, well, you know, I'll leave it up to the doctor?
Mm-hmm. I think this actually is all about asking people whether they are smokers and whether they want to quit, and acknowledging as a health professional that it's a very difficult thing to quit and that it does have significant impacts on their health, and to provide them with support. There's a lot of things available out there to help people to try and give up smoking.
Well, I've had people say to me, leave it, Sally, I'll make my own decision. Because don't we know that if they don't want to give up smoking, they're not going to be successful if we harp on it and try things anyway. It's only the people who want to change. And can I give you one example of an actual consultation I had many years ago, where this man came in and he was a very senior executive, and he sat down. It was for a corporate, you know, checkup thing. And he said, first thing I've got to say to you, doctor, is don't you dare mention my smoking. And I said, why? It's just none of your business. Because if I want to smoke, it's my business. I said, oh, you're right. You know, you're dead right. Because, you know, it doesn't make any difference to my life. I'm still going to be able to breathe. I'm not going to get short of breath. I'm not going to get cancer. I suppose your family might be involved. But no, I won't mention it again. That's fine. And as the consultation progressed, he said, oh, actually, look, are there any good ways? So I'm wondering whether there's also an embarrassment thing that a lot of people feel. Look, I don't want to feel embarrassed to talk about it.
I think that's very true. Mm. I think people do feel embarrassed, and there is a stigma about continuing to smoke, and it's a really difficult thing to bring up. But I think the campaign's also about asking people, even if the door seems completely closed, we know that people change over time.
Yeah,
and
indeed.
Keeping that door open and providing people with the opportunity to get help when they need it
indeed.
As well. Yeah.
Well, Josie, thank you very much. And look, you know, the Alfreds, it's always good, but I must admit my ears pricked up when I first heard about this campaign. I said, oh, not another thought police again. But look, I know it's not. And thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Sally.
That's Dr. Josie Sammis, who's a consultant for the GP liaison unit at the Alfred Hospital. Hello, Kay.
Hi, how are you going?
Very well, thank you.
Oh, good. I'm calling because I'm on Tampax.
Can we just say that that's a medication to try and give up smoking? Yes.
Yes, very, very expensive. And thank God I had a healthcare card. Otherwise, there's no way I would have been able to do it. Mm-hmm. I've been on them for just over 2 months and I have stopped smoking.
Well done.
Yeah, so I'm pretty proud of myself. I'm saving heaps of money. But I must say that every time my GP, if he hassled me about smoking, I would move on to the next GP.
Can I tell you, that's my concern. And I figure my patients are adults and they're educated and they know that I can see. Every time their file comes up, it tells me that they're smoking. And I figure it's reasonable once a year at the checkup time, or if some new health problem comes up. But I know, I think you're right. I think we risk people just going, no, I don't want to go to that doctor anymore.
Yeah, well, the doctor I had, he was awesome and I loved him because he used to be concerned about me smoking. Mm. He gave me the script for Tampax 12 months before I tried to fill it, and then I had to renew it because it had expired. But I knew that he went, because he was a great doctor, because he wasn't on my case.
And Kay, it has to be when the time is right for you. We just need to be there as a support system.
Yeah,
I agree with
absolutely.
You.
And he was fantastic.
Kay, thanks so much for your input, and well done on the ciggies out there. Love it. Well done. Phil, hello.
How you going?
Good. Go ahead.
People on the dole.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a small country town.
Yep.
I know of a couple of families that are on the dole. The history is on the dole.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those people, the kids have grown up, have got 3 or 4 kids.
Yep.
They don't work. They get the dole. They get the baby bonus. They get everything half price. Surely there's a job out there. There's got to be a job out there somewhere.
Hey, listen, I agree with you that I don't want anyone to be just thinking it's an entitlement just that I can do it all the time. But what do you think about telling people they're not allowed to reproduce, Phil? Isn't that going a little far?
Well, I'll give you another quick cut off of the tell them not to have kids. Mm-hmm. Don't pay them the money.
Well, that's exactly what this former MP is saying, and we'll be talking to him later. So, look, thanks for your opinion. I'm interested in it, and I'd love to hear from anyone else. Do you agree that we should say, no, if you want to have the doll, you don't have any kids? 96900 693 13 1332 is the number. We'll be back after this. Is it your doctor's place to tell you to stop smoking, or do you actually already know? And are we at risk of alienating you for it? 96900 693 is the number. Bronwyn, hello.
Hi, good afternoon, Sally. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Funny topic. I was just at the doctor's yesterday myself, mm-hmm. and a woman came out after a consultation, and she was visibly shaken and she was in tears. She sat next to me.
Oh.
So I just tried to comfort her, and she'd gone in, and she was very ill, you could tell, and what had happened was she'd gone into the GP, and she'd been sent home from work. She's got bronchitis, and the doctor just said to her, well, you know, it's because you smoke. The reason you're sick, it's you smoke. And she's like, well, yes, I know it's not helping. And she said to the doctor, look, I've got a plan in place. Mm. I plan to quit New Year's Day. That's not the issue. The issue is I'm sick. I've been told to get clearance from work for a day or two. She's like, well, I'm not giving you a day off work because it's your own fault.
What?
You smoke.
Oh, yeah, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding. I was appalled. So the woman was in tears and she went and asked to see another GP, as she should. But this doctor would not treat her, would not give her antibiotics because she said that she was smoking.
You see, this is where the message gets totally misconstrued. We are not the thought police. We are there to facilitate and help and support, and I don't think that's very supportive at all.
No, I mean, and that's exactly what we said. There shouldn't be passing judgment. She knew she was in the wrong, and,
she's not in the wrong,
I mean,
she's
the smoking. Yeah, like, and I just thought it was horrible because she was so unwell, and that's not what she was there for.
We need an education program. Obviously, there's some doctors who don't really. It's not about making people feel bad. It's not about making people feel guilty. It's about making them feel better. Bronwyn, thanks very much for your call. Really appreciate it. Now, today there's an article saying that for the first time, Victoria's road toll has risen the first time in 6 years. Police data shows 248 people have died on the state's roads this year. That's up from 243 the same time last year. I mean, I still remember the original 1970s campaign when it was, you know, we wanted to get to below 1,000 or something. So it's interesting. But on the line is Professor Russell Gruen. He's the director of the National Trauma Research Institute and a trauma surgeon at the Alfred. Professor, may I call you Russell?
Of course you can, Sally.
That's
hi.
Good. Hello, Russell. Now, listen, my bugbear with this whole thing about concentrating on road deaths while we need to is how many injuries would you say there are for every death? Or have you got some statistic on the number of injuries we have?
Yeah, we think that for every death there's at least two permanently and severely disabled people and at least 10 people whose lives are severely affected by injury. Who will go on to live for the rest of their days with the effects of a road trauma.
Well, this is what worries me, that is it time to update, for 2015, update the road toll and start including in the road toll injuries? Because I think that's still, you know, that's enormous. If there's at least 10 people affected, that's over 2,000 people affected by each of these deaths in that respect. And that's, I don't think that's coming through.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, Sally, and I think it's really a testament to the success of the Victorian system in reducing, as you said, from the Declare War on 1034 campaign
of
1969, when there were 1034 deaths on the Victorian roads. Now there's less than 300, which is a great success story.
Except,
Russell...
But, of
course, we need to focus on the injured as well as the deceased.
Indeed, and what I would say is that reduction a reflection of us really being much better drivers, or is it actually having safer cars, or both?
Look, it's a whole range of things, and don't forget better medical care too.
Absolutely.
You know, it's all about better cars, better roads, and better medical care, but the most important thing, and I'm going to be one of your listeners today who's a doctor who's not ashamed to come out and say, here's a trauma surgeon who's willing to say to everybody, drive safer. It is also very much about driver behaviour.
Yeah.
And at New Year's, it's a good reminder to everybody that some of the tragedies that we see in the Alfred Trauma Department are the results of things that just could have been avoided by some common sense
and
on the road.
The classic is, and I know lots of young people are thinking, oh, I'll do two parties tonight. I'll go to that party in Rosebud, and then I'll just nick down to Lawn. And it's that sort of driving late at night when you're tired. You think, oh, well, I won't drink. But the thing is, there's still all that risk.
Yeah, there's just no escaping the fact that a car is a real weapon when you've got speed and you've got alcohol, and if you don't treat driving a car responsibly, then you're asking for trouble.
Absolutely. Look, Russell, thank you for the work you do at the Alfred Trauma Centre, and it's and you'd like an easy couple of days, I suppose. So thank you.
I would dearly love to have the year finish without another death.
Wouldn't that be
fantastic? And also without another serious injury.
Indeed. Well, we'd love to maybe catch up with you after New Year's Eve and find out how it did go. So we might speak to you later in the week. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Sally.
That's Professor Russell Gruen. He's the director of the National Trauma Research Institute. He's also a trauma surgeon at the Alfred. And this is what I'm saying. Although, you know, we seem to have come down to 248 deaths, there may be up to 2,500 people who are affected, many of them permanently injured. We don't seem to concentrate on that. I'd like to see the road toll changed to include those injuries as well. Getting back to our smoking topic, hello, Matt.
Yeah, g'day, Sally. How are you?
Good.
That's all right. I've been a smoker for 30-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to the doctor and I said, oh, yeah, well, you can do this and you can do that. I just sort of, I've got no major incentive.
Do you want to stop?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes,
okay,
I do.
So when you say you haven't got much incentive, let me give you some incentive. If you stop smoking, you will improve your circulation and reduce your risk of heart attack, reduce your risk of stroke, and also improve your lung function. So I don't know, do you tend to get chest infections at all or anything like that? Because if you do...
No.
Oh, you don't? Look, the thing is, and we talk in a public health perspective that smoking is a risk for the population. We can't actually pick who's going to get affected by it or not, but neither can you. So the incentive is also, well, here's an incentive. How much, what you need to do is work out how much money you spend on cigarettes in a year and think what you could do with that money. There's an incentive.
Yeah.
Hey, Matt, thanks
for that's right.
Yeah,
look,
I always think lists are good, right? Lists, reason to keep smoking, reasons to stop smoking, and then you come up with what's good for you. It's got to be your incentive. You've got to decide. I don't think we should be pushing you other than to say these are the reasons why it's not a good idea. Matt, thanks for your call. Appreciate it greatly. 96900693 is the number if you have some input on this one, or maybe you've got some thoughts on the road toll too. As I say, people permanently injured. We don't hear about that side of the road toll. Hello, Greg.
Oh, Sally, how are you?
Good.
I just think there's a big difference between, as a GP, shaming people about smoking versus just bringing it up and saying, oh, you're still smoking, that's no good, because you go to the GP to get healthy, to get advice, and if the GP doesn't say that, it doesn't bring up the smoking, then patients are going to think, oh, he's not worried about it, I'm not going to be worried about it.
Very good point.
And in a similar way with, you know, if a policeman pulls you over for speeding or being over 0.05, you expect him to have a go at you about it. It's not, I ignore it because he's educated and he knows.
Oh, no, but it's just, I figure, it's time and place. Did you just hear the call from Bronwyn before about the woman who had bronchitis and the GP basically said they wouldn't give them a certificate because it's all their own fault? I think we need to temper the message. It's got to be very much, we're supporting you, we'll help you, we're here anytime you want to give it up, I think, but... thank you. Thank you for your comment. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, g'day. How you going?
Good. Go ahead.
That's good. Going back to September, my wife and I were both pretty ill with a viral disease.
Mm-hmm.
We both had, it was like a flu. We just had incessant coughing, blocked noses, migraines, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for about 8 weeks. Anyway, we both went to the same doctor. And I'm a smoker and she's not.
Mm-hmm.
As a non-smoker, the doctor took her in, gave her a course of antibiotics, which obviously wasn't going to do her any good anyway.
No,
sent her off for a chest x-ray, did this, did that. When I presented, give up smoking.
Yeah, you see, this is where I'm thinking there's a two-class system, and I think it's wrong. In medicine, if you're a smoker, we need to help you more, not tell you you're naughty. I'm over it. It's the same with obesity and sort of, oh, you brought it on yourself and blah, blah, blah. No, Jim, couldn't agree with you more. And I don't think doctors should treat people differently because of you know, if they smoke or not. It's the same as we treat people. We don't care if they're criminals or whatever. If they've got a health problem, we'll deal with it. Now, in the studio, the fabulous, the wonderful Tony Tardio.
Sally, good afternoon to you. An ambulance helicopter is on its way to a serious crash at Tooradin. Three people are in a serious condition after a bus collided with a car on the South Gippsland Highway around 3 o'clock. It's understood one person is trapped. A US warship and another Australian plane have joined the expanded search for the missing AirAsia passenger plane off Indonesia. It's been revealed that before takeoff, the pilot had asked permission to fly at a high level to avoid a storm. The search for an Australian man reported missing while climbing New Zealand's tallest mountain isn't likely to resume until New Year's Day. Michael Bishop, who's believed to be about 40, had been scaling Mount Cook on the South Island with two Germans early yesterday morning. Tasmanian authorities say aviation headphones and an aircraft headset have been recovered from the water where a light plane crashed yesterday. And in sport, India 3-97 after being set a target of 384 to win the Boxing Day test at the MCG. Kohli has just posted his 50. He's not out 52. Sally, we'll have those stories.
Do you know what I've got in my hand, Tony?
Well, you've got one of those selfie sticks.
He'll be back at 4 o'clock. I've got a selfie stick because there's someone saying that selfie sticks are the ultimate indulgence, self-indulgence. And you know why they're good? Because I can reach over there to you and yes. I could take your photo.
Well, you're taking my... Why would you want to get that close, though?
Because
I thought you were taking a photograph of yourself.
No, I was going to take a photo of you, Tony, but no.
Why don't we take one?
We'll done together. We'll do that in the break. Okay. So you're back at 4?
I will be.
We'll see you then. That's what we're talking about after the break. Love to hear your thoughts. Have you got a selfie stick? I know I have. I'm going to go and take Tony's photo with me. Bye bye.
3AW traffic. Get the power of Tyre Power's summer scorcher sale.
Well, the major arterials all very light, still in holiday mode with standard travel times across the board, but quite a few accidents to contend with, including one in Tacoma on the Burwood Highway near Glenfern Road. All emergency crews are on site in Dandy South too on the South Kippy Highway, not far from the drive-in. Got a cyclist down in queue now. It's on Willis Street just as you turn left off Princes Street. It's affecting northbound traffic on Princes Street there, just approaching the roundabout. Got a crash in Heatherton as well, clearing from Kingston Road near Warrigal Road, and that first water main in Brighton still blocking eastbound lanes of South Road at New Street. Dendy Street or Weir Street, a good alternative. And that's 3AW traffic. Flight Centre's Boxing Day sale is on now. Like Auckland, flying Qantas return from $363. Call 131 600. I'm Chris Miller.
This is Drive with Sally Coburn.
Later in the program, we'll be looking at that issue, a very important issue, of why men still wear ties. Do you still wear a tie? I'd love to hear from you. So we talk about women's rights all the time and whether women should be able to wear pants, but why do you guys wear ties? I remember I spoke to my partner about this some time back and I said, why do you wear a suit and a tie? And he said, well, because that's what's expected of me. Is it? Love to hear you. 96900 693. Don't forget, word on the street, what's happening around you? Is anything going on? Love to hear from you. $200 voucher from the Pancake Parlour is in the offing. As I said, 96900 693 or 13 1332. But we're talking about smoking and whether your GP needs to harp on about smoking at you, or should we just say once a year, hey, listen, you need to deal with that. Hello, France.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Sally.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I would let you know that I've got a few things to talk about.
Sure.
My father was a very heavy smoker.
Mm-hmm.
He decided himself that he would stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
He used to smoke 4 packets a day.
Whoa. Whoa. Right?
Now, he used to even get up during the night.
He had an addiction.
Yes. Now, the way that we did it is that I personally bought him one of those little cases for putting the cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
and we put it in 10 cigarettes instead of 36 or 30.
That's a good idea. So that's the same approach we take to trying to lose weight, have a smaller plate. Mm.
And it worked.
Yeah.
Now, he totally stopped smoking in less than 8 months.
Well, look, see, this is what people need, support. They need to help have people help them, not say, oh, could you just get rid of those things? Or stop smoking or you're going to die. I think we need to be supportive. I'm sure that's the case. France, you said you had something else.
Yes. Regarding that lady that went to that GP,
yeah,
she should report it to that GP.
Yeah, that's what I think. That we all have practice managers, and you can say to the practice manager or write to the practice manager to say why you're upset. Obviously, it's going to be more powerful if it comes from the from the actual patient who had it. Or you can tell one of the other doctors when you go back there. I agree with you. Thanks for your call, France. Appreciate it greatly. And 96900 693, if you've got any thoughts on the issue of smoking and who should be telling who about how to give up and the best attack. Maybe you've been really successful and maybe you want a pep talk. I'm happy to give you a pep talk. Now, we have been hearing reports about some oil slicks and whether there's debris, and it's been discounted that that debris is probably not from AirAsia flight QZ8501. Of course, we don't know where it is. We're all talking fairly much like it's gone down. But on the line is Eric Van Sebel. He's an oceanographer from the University of New South Wales. Eric, can I ask you, you know, when do you think it's likely that we're going to see something emerge?
Well, that's a very difficult question, of course.
Mm. What does it depend on?
Any day now. Mm. Well, it really depends on where exactly the plane hit the water. Mm-hmm. If it's in an area where there's a lot of people, then we can actually start seeing people look at the ocean and actually see the debris. If it's a little bit further away, that's going to be very difficult.
Well, it also depend if it landed on sandy bottom or rocky bottom, if it didn't break up, or is it quite likely it broke up, or we don't know?
Well, that all depends on how it actually hit the water and whether it broke up immediately. I think the real problem here is that there's just so much debris in the ocean already. There's so much just going on, and this is an area with a lot of shipping, with a lot of fishing, with a lot of people living around the coast, yeah. And it's just filthy, essentially. There's all this plastic floating around, and if you're going to look for the debris for the plane, there's bound to be many more of these false positives that we saw already, mm. where the spotter planes actually think that they saw something.
That happened with the Malaysian Airlines flight as well, that people kept seeing things and thinking it was fuselage, and then it was just junk in the ocean. It's awful to think we've got so much junk in the ocean.
Absolutely. And this story will again show that there is just too much filth. In this case, I think what will be a real problem is what we call ghost nets. They're abandoned fishing nets. And they are made to fish, essentially. They can float around for years. They can be 10, 20 meters in size. So they're pretty big. And the Indonesian seas are full of them because there's just so much fishing going on. Because they're so big, they look a bit like airplane pieces, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And that would make it really a prime target and a prime something that people think this is going to be a piece of plane. But it is just going to be another piece of junk.
What about the comparison between trying to find this plane and trying to find the Malaysian Airlines plane? Is there any sort of, that was in such deep water, is this going to be somewhat easier? I use the word lightly there.
Yes, I think so. So MHC-70, where we are still searching, is probably the hardest place in the world to search for something. Mm-hmm. It is so deep, it is so remote, it is so inaccessible. The Java Sea, what we're talking about now, is 100 times shallower.
Oh, okay.
It's only 40, 50 meters deep. And actually, during the last ice age, it was actually a forest.
Oh.
It was actually above sea level. So this is hardly an ocean. This is just what we call an inland sea, a bit like Bass Strait between Victoria and Tasmania.
Yeah.
That means that we have a lot of experience working in these kind of depths. Offshore industries, wind farms, oil production facilities, they often work in these kind of depths. And it means that all the technology is just off the shelf.
Sure.
Unlike with MHC-70, where we had to kind of like go around the world to search for the handful of instruments that could actually go down deep enough,
yeah.
Here anybody really has this equipment.
So what's your take on it? What if your best estimate of how long it's going to take and what we're likely to find? Like, will it be something?
I would hope it would really be much faster than MHC-70. Yeah. Really, a matter of days.
Okay. And is it likely to be, can I say, suitcases landing on beaches somewhere? I mean, is that the sort of thing that might happen?
I don't know. That's hard for me to predict, of course. Because that really much more depends on how the plane disintegrated.
Indeed. Look, I just hope we get an end for it, because closure for those poor families is we need some
end. Absolutely. That is so important.
Yeah.
And I totally understand that closure is just critical here.
Indeed.
And everybody, not only the families, they of course too, but anybody wants to know what happened with this plane. Anybody who ever set foot in a plane wants to know why these kind of things happen.
Totally.
And what we can learn from it to make air travel safer.
And I hope that one thing that comes out of this, because I picked that up too in MH370, is I hope we actually look at our oceans and realise it's time we actually all clean them up a bit. But look, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Eric Van Sebel, the oceanographer at the University of New South Wales. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
No worries. worries.
Now, coming up after the break, you may have read this morning there was a 17-year-old person who won the right to have a sex change and was taken to court with against their parents. And be interested in your thoughts, 96900 693. We'll be back after this with that. There's an article in the Herald Sun, I should say, this morning, and the headline says, "Student 17 gets sex change go ahead despite parents' objections." It caught my eye. This young person went to court and was given judicial approval to go ahead and have a gender reassignment operation at the age of 17. Evidently, Isaac was born female, now lives as a male, moved to Australia from Asia on a student visa in 2009. 3 years later, at the age 14, he began living openly as a male, which angered his parents. So this brings up several issues, which is our understanding of these issues that young people may face in this sort of situation. Also, it brings up the legal issue of when can someone make decisions for themselves. But first of all, to look at the issue of growing up with feelings about your gender identity. On the line is someone who really understands this, although it's a slightly different story, and I'll get him to explain that. Is a person I admire greatly is Tony Briffer, who former mayor of Hobson's Bay. Tony is also an intersex person, and Tony, maybe I can ask you to explain the difference in this sort of situation.
Dr. Sally, lovely to be on your program.
I love
Thank
having you,
for you
Tony.
Today. the difference between intersex and trans. Well, in my case, for people like me that are intersex, we're born biologically, part male and part female. So that's, we're previously called hermaphrodites or pseudo-hermaphrodites, but we're biologically part male and part female. Whereas in the trans case, a person is born biologically one sex, but with the gender identity of the opposite sex.
Mm. But the problems probably are much the same, is that in that if someone assigns you at birth a particular gender and you're brought up as that gender, but you don't feel that's your gender, or in fact it turns out that's not your gender, whose decision is it to change?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because in the case of trans people, so like this young man, Isaac, who I know and I admire, he's a lovely young guy, in his case, he has to go to court. So a court had to make a decision as to whether he's capable of making a decision. Whereas, unfortunately, with intersex people like me, there is no judicial process. We don't have a voice. Doctors make that decision on our behalf when we're very young, and they remove healthy organs to normalise us without any court approval and without our consent and without it being medically necessary.
Yeah, I think this is... is this still going on, Tony? Because obviously you're... May I ask how old you are?
Sure, I'm 44. It is still happening.
Well, doctors are making... Do they ask the parents or what do they do?
Yeah, they make a number of medical tests. They work out what is more likely for the child going to be, whether male or female. And that's fine. It's wonderful that they raise the child and they recommend to raise the child as a male or a female. Mm. But the problem is they can get the assignment wrong. And in the meantime, they've conducted medical surgery on them. They've removed healthy organs, for example, removed testes on a child that they're raising as a girl, only to find out later that child actually identifies as a boy. And they've already castrated them.
So that means they've got no hope of reproduction.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what happened to me here at the Royal Children's Hospital. And in fact, they even go further. They do things like give them hormone treatment, so female hormone treatment early, to stunt their growth so they can, look more female and all that sort of thing. I mean, they really control...
I suppose, let's just look at the devil's advocate position, Tony, which is, so how would you advise then if someone was born intersex and you looked at them and you did a blood test and their genetics were a bit of both sort of thing, if I can be crass, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But what do we do? Who do we bring, or do we wait and see where they go? What do we do?
Exactly. Look, if there's anything medically necessary, of course, absolutely do it. You raise the child as a male or a female, and that may change later on in life.
Mm.
You don't limit options by removing healthy organs, such as, ovaries or testes. And you understand that there are males, there are females, and sometimes there are people that are both.
Mm.
And that's okay, as long as they're healthy. And later on, they can make a decision for themselves. And if they consent to having gender surgery or having bits removed, then that's fine.
Mm. Now, I'm surprised that Isaac at 17 had to go to court, because I thought the age of consent was considered 16. But is it? I mean, and also there's the medico-legal issue of mature minor, which obviously I read in the paper said that Isaac was deemed to be able to give consent.
Yes, it was. Yeah, normally they go, as you know, with GILIC competency,
yeah.
And traditionally, or more recently, with transgender cases, they haven't been able to, or they've been able to consent to hormone blockers and hormone treatment from the age of 16, but not have any irreversible surgery until the age of 18.
By the age of 16, there's a certain amount of biology that's happened, I would imagine.
That's right.
You know, and this whole thing, and we need to deal with it. These are young people who are saying, I feel this way, and I know I'm going to stay feeling this way. And I suppose what we're saying is, are you sure you're not going to change your mind?
That's right. So doing things like hormone blockers to prevent the onset of puberty for them, and then when they get a bit older and they've gone through a process, they want to have hormones to actually change to the opposite sex, then if that's what they want to do and they're competent, then so be it. And then when they're adults, they can usually, when they're 18 or in this case 17, they can then provide consent for surgery.
Tony, I have to say that I absolutely admire the work you've done in the community, and also for being so open about your own story. It's wonderful, and it must help so many people.
Thank you. I might as well be open and honest about it. I was raised in Altona and was raised as Antoinette over here, became mayor as Tony over here. So I am open and honest about it, and I think the community appreciates it.
Oh, I think, look, I know you do have the admiration of your community, and I know I've been over to Hobson's Bay and seen how much people really respect you, and you are a wonderful role model for intersex people, so that they can see that, you know, may as well be out there and do it. Well done.
Absolutely.
Tony, look, thank you very much for your time. And are you still on the council, by the way?
No, I've resigned. I resigned in March this year, and I'm now back in my career of aviation.
Oh, are you in aviation?
Well, yeah,
we should have asked you. We should have asked you about this plane, but you don't want to put your two penneth worth in. No, we need to go to a break. Tony Briffa, thank you so much for your time. Tony, of course, is the former mayor of Hobson Bay, an absolutely wonderful man, and I have to say he has done some incredible things in his public life, and one of the most incredible things was to actually come out and tell us about his past. Love to hear from you. 96900 693. It is 5. Today we've been talking about whether your doctor should be pontificating to you about giving up smoking every time you go in there, or they should just be gentle supporters. I'd love to hear your thoughts. 96900 693. After the break, we're going to be talking about another interesting solution for the world's ills, and that is that you can't have the dole unless you promise not to have kids. We've just heard Tony Briffa on human rights issues about that. I'll be interested in your thoughts. 96900 693. Also, we'll be talking about the humble selfie stick. I have one. I love it. I love it a lot. But someone says I'm a total egotist. Okay, we'll be talking about that. I'll be taking him on in a very political way. Don't you worry about that. See you after the news. Great to be with you this afternoon, and if you'd like to be part of the show, 96900 693. Now, just before we get into our next story, I will do a bit of a disclaimer, and that is that I have for 25 years talked about relationships and sex on the radio. Not only that, I am a GP, I prescribe and treat people for those sort of things, and I am a former chair of Family Planning Victoria and a patron of Marie Stopes International. And I'm smiling because Gary Johns, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. You are from the Australian Institute of Progress, also a columnist for the Australian, and no surprise, it is about your article today in the Australian that says no contraception, no dole. Gary, why?
Well, Sally, we observe that some people continue to conceive or have children while they're on a benefit. And they, of course, are creating for themselves a real headache. So, if you like, it's more a chance to intervene at a point in a life where you say, now hang on, you really can't afford this. It doesn't mean to say that when you're off the benefit, you can't restart your family. It's really that question of, well, if you want the benefit, let's talk about some obligations. And, of course, having children is a major commitment. And if someone else is paying for it, then I think we got to have a discussion.
But isn't that the classic slippery slope? I mean, aren't we sort of having politicians stepping into people's bedrooms and deciding their reproductive future?
No. The politician, if you like, but really the taxpayer, stepped into all sorts of places the moment we decided to pay benefits to anyone on any basis, right? Mm. We've already had that sort of cultural decision made many generations ago. So we now decide that for a particular benefit, for instance, you should be searching for work, or you should have a lack of income or a lack of assets or be of a certain age. We already surround any benefit with certain obligations. And this would be a further potential obligation.
Would it be, is it an obligation or a mandate from the government saying you're not allowed to have babies? What if, and as a doctor, I realise your background is in economics and you're a former minister in the Keating government. I know that from an economic point of view, this makes perfect sense. But from a human perspective, reproduction isn't something that is always a given, and that there are times in people's lives where they are more fertile or less fertile. Some people can't take contraception, and moreover, and this is the big one, can't afford it. Wouldn't we be better off offering free contraception and educating people than saying big stick?
Not better off, but that's a good alternative. Mm-hmm. So let's have that discussion. The point is, you have this sort of tripwire, if you like. The person can say, well, I now need the state's help because my partner's left me, or I'm become unemployed or unwell or whatever. And you say, okay, well, look, it really isn't going to help if you now start a family or have another child or whatever. So I agree with you. We might get into this conversation that says to people who otherwise wouldn't perhaps be on contraception or don't know enough about it or whatever, put them in your hands. But that you have a mechanism there. You have that first discussion where the person comes in seeking benefits to talk about them.
Well, Gary, I mean, I see, again, you know, you can have the conversation, but with your sort of mandatory suggestion of mandatory contraception, I mean, who's going to police it? And moreover, how are you going to police it? I mean, are you going to go around to their house and put the condom on? I mean,
No. And clearly, you'll advise me, but as far as I know, that the only long-term contraception available is for women, and that's Depo-Provera.
It's not Depo-Provera, it's the implant is it lasts longer, it's 3 years. The Depo-Provera injection is 3 months. But again,
but you wouldn't want a three-year, because most people aren't on a benefit for that long. But the point being...
But that's mandatory medication. How can we make people take
it? It's not mandatory. It's not mandatory.
Oh, because it says in the article.
You have a choice.
Oh, you don't go on benefits.
That's right. You have a choice. So
you can starve or you can take the pill.
The point being that, yes, if you have a note from your doctor, that would satisfy a criterion and so on, you go and receive the benefit.
So I could actually write a note to say, you know, Mary Jones can't go on the pill, so give her the benefit.
Oh, yes.
Would there be a Medicare item number for that in your regime? Because
You'd have to apply it very sensitively, but the point is you'd have the conversation.
Look, I agree with you. This is a great conversation to have. And I've got the view, if we want to fix climate change in the whole world, we should look at contraception worldwide. I'd love contraception to be free. Are you with me?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me that much. Yes, that's fine. As long as a person has a choice, and as I say, the free choice...
But you're not giving them a choice, Gary.
It's partly curtailed when they seek the benefit of someone else, that is, the taxpayer.
That's
the point at which you have the conversation.
Okay, but it's a little bit more than a conversation that you're suggesting. You're suggesting you've got a choice. It's get the doll or get on contraception, and so starve or have kids. And I'm happy with the conversation. I'm just not happy with the...
Or starve and have kids.
You're probably talking
about people in desperate circumstances.
Then
often.
Nature will take over and turn off your ovulation. But this is the other thing. It is very sexist, if you will, in one sense, in that men, there is no sort of other way of doing this with men unless you say, sign here that you'll wear a condom. Or you could argue, I mean, and this is where you start to get on that. I mean, what about the only option for men would be to have a vasectomy? Now, they're not while we may be able to reverse them, I mean, do you see the slippery slope we're doing here?
No, there's no slippery slope. We await you scientists to to provide.
Give it to us, we'll fix it.
I know, you've got broad shoulders or whatever. We await science to be able to do for men what can be done for women, and we're not talking about any permanent interventions at all.
Yeah. Gay, I just think it's sort of moving away. I mean, I've noticed that the Australian Institute for Progress says that you exist to advance discussion, development and implementation of public policy. You promote classic rights, freedom of expression, freedom of association, property rights, freedom of worship, freedom of markets. This strikes me as a bit difficult. Also, what about people who are Catholic, for example, who may have a religious reason for wanting to have children, and this goes against their religion?
Yeah, again, this is not nearly so dominant in the Catholic religion as was once the case. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that.
But what about for the people? What about for the people who feel it is?
But for those whom it is, and it's a bit like any compulsion that the state seeks, for instance, conscription, you always have an out.
Well, and the out is not to get the doll.
No. I mean, an out that you. It would be too much of an ask for you to fill the obligation, okay. Yes.
Because the other thing is, we've only in recent years been able to stop employers discriminating against pregnant women, and here would be the government stepping in. I can see there's going to be lots of discussion on this one, Gary.
There will indeed. So, and look, I'm thinking particularly, and I see a lot of cases that go through courts, it's not my job, but I just see them, where there are circumstances where there are two children and then along comes the second family when really there's no one working. You think, why child three, four or whatever?
Yeah.
And this is really crueling the chances of the first two. And okay, we have a very generous welfare system. We have lots of good charities that are willing to help out. But this is after the horse has bolted, literally. And we're only talking about the fact that many people, and most people, I think, on benefits, are only there for a while. Mm. It gives them pause to think.
So if we've only got a small percentage of the population who may be the problem children, if you will, then maybe shouldn't we educate them? Shouldn't we inform them? And shouldn't we be concentrating on them rather than a sort of a blanket nut? If you want the doll, you've got to go on.
I agree with the education, and I think good people like yourself and many others that I know have been at it for a long time, and we do some good. But
so can I just ask you, Gary, do you really honestly believe this is good policy, or is this sort of like a slow news day and it's great to promote the Australasian Institute of Progress?
It's a perfect conversation.
Perfect conversation, not necessarily perfect perfect policy. Gary, thanks. Loved the conversation. It was great to speak to you. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye then. That was Gary Johns, who's a former minister in the Keating government. As I said in the promo, it doesn't sound like someone coming from that side of politics. We're going to take a break now. 96900693 is the number, 131332. You are listening to Drive. Listen online, listen digital, or listen through the 3IW app. Speak to you after this. It's 17 past four. Now, when it comes to tech, I love it. I've been teching for years. I've been making my own website. If it's a gadget, I want it. And so it sort of sounds a bit strange when a 56-year-old doctor is sitting here saying that I reckon a selfie stick's the best thing since sliced bread. And on the line is a wonderful young journalist from the Herald Sun, Angus Thompson, who says that selfie sticks are the epitome of being self-centred. Welcome, Angus.
Oh, how are you going?
This is a bit of role reversal, isn't it?
Sorry?
A bit of role reversal. I mean, here's a hipster young guy telling this old chook that, you know, get away with your tech.
Look, it is a bit strange, but I just don't get it. I think you might have to explain what all the fuss is about, really.
Well, I tell you, you obviously are a bloke with long arms, because I've got to tell you, one of the biggest problems with taking photos is I've got short arms, and I always cut the other person out of the photo or cut myself out. The selfie stick has allowed me to do the group shot.
Well, I'm pretty stunted, actually. I've got pretty short arms, so I just don't take selfies, period. I don't see the need.
Well, who takes your selfies? We've had a little check out of your Facebook site.
Oh, have you? I thought you'd do a bit of research.
We do our research, don't you worry about that. There's a couple of photos there that, well, your arm is in a position that it looks like a selfie.
Absolutely. Okay, you got me. There's nothing wrong with taking the odd selfie. However, I think it goes a bit over the top sometimes when you're taking them a few times a day.
Look, this is true.
That's why I don't get what the selfie stick is all about, because why would you accessorize with something basically chilling the desire to take a take a selfie, multiple times a day. I just don't get it.
Okay, let me sell it to you, because I think the other thing, and I've just stretched it out, I used it to move the lights up in the studio. If anyone's watching now, they can see me moving the lights. And I also find that, what if you're, have you ever been along to a concert where you just want to get that really good shot, but the person, sit down. Well, you can hold it above your head and get a fabulous photo of whoever's playing on the or at the sport or whatever. You don't get in people's way.
No, because when I go to a concert, I'm too involved in the music. I'm not too involved in taking photos. You've got to be in the moment. That's what it's all about.
But don't you want to prove...
just enjoy it.
How do you prove you were there?
Oh, you don't have to take a selfie to do that. You can point the camera directly at whoever's playing, or if you're going hiking.
Yeah, but Angus, this is where the selfie comes in, you see, because the selfie gives you that reach.
Does it?
Yeah.
I think for me, the rich experience, you've been there. Who do you have to prove that to? You just go out and you enjoy your life.
I have to prove it to my child that I actually did attend some cool events, in the past, because she thinks I'm sort of, only listen to rubbishy music.
Oh, okay. So that's where it comes into. You have to prove your children.
But can I tell you what? What I used, I took selfies. I took my daughter around Europe and I took selfies in front of, all sorts of the Eiffel Tower, in front of the Colosseum. Yep. I mean, that's where they're wonderful. Come on, that's a great thing, isn't it?
That's where they're awful. Why would you take a selfie in front of the Colosseum? Why wouldn't you not be enjoying that rich history?
I did.
So many people standing in front of ancient ruins taking selfies. That's atrocious.
I enjoyed it. And then I turned around and said, how much more am I going to enjoy it when I get home to see that I really was there?
No. See, that's what the memories are about. You don't want to be in that. You don't want to go back and look at that photo and see your cheesy grin popping up.
Yeah, no, Angus, you're young, you see. You can remember.
Okay, maybe if you use it as a memory aid, that's okay. I'll let you have that one.
Now, I just want to know, how do hard-working Herald Sun journalists work over the Christmas New Year? Where are you at the moment? Are you
I'm sitting on a beach at Bermagui, so I'm still working. You've made me pick up the phone and get all riled up over this thing. But, no, journalists never stop, even when we're on holiday.
So are you tempted to get a selfie stick? Come on, be honest.
I'm not at all. You know what? I have to admit, back maybe 6 months ago when they were popping up here and there, I go, oh, that's a novel idea. And I got it. I'm like, you know what? Okay, it comes in handy. But now everyone's got them. They're just bobbing up around.
Hey, you know why? Because it's under $30 and it's a present you can give to someone.
It is. It is. Absolutely. But isn't that scary over Christmas? Absolutely everyone wore one. It scared me. It really did. Everyone's so obsessed with taking these things. Everyone's got one.
I have to say, though, it's been wonderful for me because I do have these short arms and I can get group shots, although you've got to sort of deal with the timing mechanism and I don't know. But I have to say, just for people who don't know what they are, they're sort of like they look like a baton that you hold in your hand, and you can put your phone in the stretchy bit up there. You can angle the phone. You can then stretch it out to be about sort of 4 foot long. And look, they're fun, Angus. Why?
Dangerous.
I want one, Angus. I want one.
In the streets with those ones. You really have to convince me to get one here. I'm not sure I'm being won over just yet.
Damn. Angus, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Have a good one.
You too. Enjoy your beach. Put on plenty of sunscreen and a hat, please. Angus, forget. It's 26 past four.
Finance for Home Safe Wealth Release. For senior homeowners, change nothing, change everything.
Now, from the frivolous to the finance, we have the gorgeous Scott Haywood from thefinanceguru.com.au. Have you got a selfie stick, Scott?
Oh, I haven't got a selfie stick, Sally, but what I did, I suppose, if you look at 2014, for many investors, they had to have a good hard look at themselves in the mirror because the share market only is going to return around about 1.5% for the year. So it hasn't been a great year. So the selfie of the share market and the selfie of me hasn't really happened. But today our market was easy. We rose yesterday over 2%. Today we were down 1% or 54 points. To 5,392, but today was the last full trading day of the year. Tomorrow, the share market wraps up at 2 o'clock, so of course, normally the market closes at 4. And overnight in the US, there's pretty much an uneventful night in terms of major data release. This time of year is pretty quiet, but Allianz, their shares that they're listed in Germany, they fell just under 2% because, of course, unfortunately, they're going to be the insurer of AirAsia. So they're going to, their shares were battered down a little bit last night. But in terms of the year, the iron ore price has been the big issue for Australia. The share price, your iron ore price has fallen 50% in value, and last night oil prices also dropped to 5-year lows. So the five largest companies in that industry, Santos down 3%, Woodside Petroleum, Oil Search, Origin and Caltex all down more than 1%. But in terms of mining companies, BHP and Rio Tinto are down a little bit less than that, but Fortescue bucked the trend as iron ore prices went up last night, up 2 cents to $2.75, and Commonwealth Bank came off its all-time high, hitting 86.65 in early trade this morning to close at 85.58. But the day was probably, I suppose, the highlight was a company called Sodeco. It is in the ASX 200. They got the highest possible grade from their copper mine. They were up 26 cents or 18% to $1.75. But as I said, Sally, it looks like it's going to be a pretty flat year for the share market. As I said, I think we're looking at gains of only about 1.5%. That doesn't include dividends. That's just what the All Ordinaries benchmark will do. Of course, if you put your money in a term deposit, you're getting 3%. But if you had your money in Melbourne property, you've probably had returns of closer to 8 or 10%.
That sounds like good stuff. And I think maybe after, see, when I do these stints with you, I start to think, God, I've got to get my share portfolio happening. So you're getting me sort of hot fired about that, Scott.
I'm getting you motivated. Go ahead, Sally. No,
thank you very much. Oh, hang on, I've got to, I know that you don't have a selfie stick, but do you think that, you know, they're silly and self-indulgent, or do you think...
Look, I think...
have you got shares in them?
Maybe I'm in a different age group. You see, I sort of came in to selfies only in the last couple of years. Maybe if you're between maybe 18 and, say, 30, maybe that's the age group. Maybe it's between 16 and 25, but I'm a little bit older than that, so maybe...
I'm 56 and I love it. Hey, Scott, thanks very much for your time. See you tomorrow. Bye. That's Scott Haywood from The Finance Guru. And, of course, it is now time for headlines, news headlines with the Tony Tardio. I just tweeted that photo of you and me, Tony.
Oh, dear, I wasn't happy with my photograph, but you looked absolutely
you looked wonderful.
Gorgeous, Sally.
I thought you looked lovely. What's happening in the news?
A car and a bus have collided at Tooradin on the South Gippsland Highway. A woman in her 80s has suffered critical injuries. A man in his 70s is serious, and another woman is in stable condition. Australia has boosted its contribution to the search effort for the missing AirAsia plane, sending another two P3 Orion aircraft. A number of ships and planes continue to scour Indonesian waters for any sign of the passenger jet that vanished from the radar on Sunday. New Zealand authorities have suspended the search for an Australian man and two Germans on Mount Cook on the South Island. The three are overdue to reach the summit of the country's tallest mountain, with bad weather preventing crews from safely searching the region. And in sport, Australia needs six more wickets in the final session for victory in the Boxing Day Test match against India at the MCG. Virat Kohli was caught at square leg off the first ball after tea. India currently 4 for 116. Sally, we'll have those stories in the news at 5.
Thanks, Tony. I don't even know what a square leg is, but that's okay. I don't know what bowling a maiden over means either.
A position on the field.
Oh, a position on the field. Thank you very much. A square leg. I'll remember that one. Thank you so much, Tony Tardio. Back at 4. Coming up, when cheating is involved in a relationship, and we hear people going on about it, why is the other person involved, as in the other woman or the other man? Why aren't we fairly and squarely putting the blame on the person doing the cheating? We'll be talking a bit about that. Happy to hear your thoughts. 96900 693. It is 4:30.
3AW traffic.
Get the power of Tyre Power summer scorcher sale.
Bit of a mess in Tooradin after a particularly nasty accident on the South Gippsland Highway, not far from the river crossing and not far from the original crash, another one involving a rolled car. Got four tow trucks on site clearing up in Dandenong South after a nasty one on the South Gippsland Highway again, this time at the Dandenong Bypass, and in Tacoma on the Burwood Highway near Glenfern Road. Got all emergency crews on site there. They're in Berwick and are mopping up after a three-car crash on O'Shea Road at Clyde Road, and in Doncaster on Victoria Street just south of George Street. Got some delays. All the freeways, though, in excellent shape. And that's 3AW traffic. Stay tuned this January for the new and exciting Weight Watchers. They're launching smart new innovations, which are simple to use, making your weight loss goals easier to reach. I'm Chris Miller.
This is Drive with Sally Coburn.
Don't forget, word on the street, a $200 pancake parlour voucher is on the offing if you are out there and things are happening. 96900 693 or 131332 is the number. However, before we get back into calls, on the line is Paul Dowsley, Channel 7 reporter, who's on the scene at the Tooradin crash. Now, Paul, what's gone on there?
Hi there, Sally. It seems that a single vehicle, it's a minibus or maybe a camper van, has veered off the road here, off the South Gippsland Highway in Tooradin, and right in the main strip, gone straight into a tree. Oh. Three people in the vehicle have been injured, two of them trapped in the front. The male driver trapped only for a short time, but the lady next to him was trapped for more than an hour. She's just come out in the past 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and about a minute ago the air ambulance has flown her from an oval just nearby here, going to the Alfred.
Jimmy just had the trauma, one of the trauma surgeons on from the Alfred, hoping that there wouldn't be any more. And so, you know, it's very, very sad. They're still there. And are there any other people around that have been involved or?
No, it was just the three people in the in the van, thankfully. Okay. The van has clipped a couple of parked cars here as it's gone into the tree. But thankfully, just three people injured. There could have been more because it was very busy around here. The pub was full. It was, just about 2:45. So a lot of people around, and obviously at this time of the year.
Indeed.
It could have been a lot worse.
Well, look, thank you for your time, Paul, and reporting on that. And as you say, that the one woman has been airlifted to the Alfred, and they're still removing the other man from the bus. So thank you very much. Appreciate this. Paul Dowsley, the Channel 7 reporter on the scene at Turriden. And look, that's a really salient message. We spoke to one of the trauma surgeons at the Alfred, where one of the members of that car is now headed. He actually put out a plea for us to be careful on the road. Obviously, you know, accidents still happen, but we really do need to realise that your life can change in an instant, and please take care on the roads. Now, something caught my eye today, again in the paper. It was the announcement of another celebrity split, Helen Bonham Carter and Tim Burton split. There was some talk about whether there was another person involved, and that made me sort of think, I don't know, do we talk too much about these private things? On the line is Jo Casamento. She's the entertainment guru. And I believe, Jo, you are currently languishing on a banana lounge or something at the Versace. Fabulous place.
It is a fabulous, very fabulous place. And I have to say, I'm keeping my eye out. I'm sure there are a few affairs going on up here as we speak.
So I reckon. I actually once did a seminar up there, and I was in this room, and I kept discovering rooms off the room, and I'm thinking, how big is this apartment? It was amazing.
I know. I have never seen as much gilded gold, more opulent chandeliers, and Gary cushions, as well as plenty of Camilla caftans on the women up here. That's
and
sure
the smell, one. the beautiful fragrance in the, it was like, buy me.
Yes.
Now, Joe, let's talk about this issue of the other woman/man. That seems to be always when we talk about celebrity splits, we're looking for who's the other person involved. But isn't it the person who had the affair that's the problem?
Oh, absolutely. And I think we always go to blame the other woman.
Or man.
I don't think we really do blame the other man.
That's interesting.
The other woman. And it's an interesting thing because the focus is always on the floozy, the young floozy that stole the heart. And I think sometimes it's interesting when it's an older woman. I remember that everyone was shocked. The entire world was shocked, remember, when Michael Hutchence took up with Paula Yates and dumped poor old Helena Christensen, a supermodel who actually is currently on a picture in the foyer as we speak in her Versace outfit. But it is interesting because we usually do blame the other woman. And I was just reading earlier about the new show, which I can't wait to see, about Eddie and Leanne Rimes. I don't know if you follow them.
I have been watching the promos. Yes, do tell.
I'm so intrigued to watch this. So this is a new reality show based on their relationship. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the whole ins and outs of the sagas of Hollywood, Eddie was married to Brandy Glanville. Now, if you're a Real Housewife fan, you'll know her from the Beverly Hills franchise. And she's quite outspoken, and she, you know, gets a lot of plastic surgery, and she always gets herself into trouble because she kind of says a lot of things before thinking. But she's become quite popular, but the reason she's on the show is that her husband left her for Leanne Rimes, who I remember growing up quite a cutesy country singer.
Yeah.
And she became the other woman in this scandal, and it's been splashed across the front pages of all the tabloids there for the last few years. And she got, you know, a fairly bad reputation. So it will be interesting.
So who got the bad reputation, Leanne or Brandy?
Leanne. Even though Brandy, you know, kind of had a bit of a trash-tastic reputation, Leanne was definitely seen as the other woman. And I almost think it's the producers rubbing. It's cruel. It's like a cruel torture that the producers are rubbing their hands together. They've got this one poor woman on one show who is constantly in a state of tears and flux because she's got no money, she's a single mum, she's this, she's that. You know, this woman ran off and stole her husband. And now the producers are, you know, parlaying that into another spin-off series. So
you
it's
see,
kind of cruel in a way.
I'd love to know how you steal a person, because doesn't Eddie have a will? Can't he make a decision for himself? I mean, just talking about generally in cheating situations, and I don't know whether he cheated or not, but the thing is that...
Well, he was a known philanderer because... And I don't know if you're familiar with
no,
the other,
obviously not.
The other spin-off from the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Vanderpump Rules, one of the central characters is Lisa Vanderpump, who owns several restaurants there, and one of her waitresses, her cocktail waitresses, had hooked up with Eddie as well, I think prior to Leanne. So he was a known philanderer, and you're right, Randy at the time did focus and they had a bit of a catfight, there were glasses thrown and all those things. But you're right, it is the man, it is the person that has the affair at fault. And it was interesting, you mentioned to me, and I was quite saddened to hear the news of Tim Burton.
Well, that was in the paper, I'm assuming it's genuine.
Yeah, it is absolutely genuine. They have announced their split. It was announced in a statement last week. And they, although they were never married, they were together for 13 years. Mm. They have two children, a boy, Billy, who's 11, and Nell, who's 6. They have admitted over the years they had, they always had a very an interesting and fascinating relationship. They had knocked down 3 townhouses in London there, and she lived in one, which was designed to her taste. He lived in the other, which was designed to his taste, and in the middle, the children and the nanny lived.
Love it.
So they've obviously always lived this very, crazy life, which doesn't suit most people.
Is it crazy, or is it actually the best life you could ever have, which is you get your independence and you have your relationship?
Absolutely. As they said, when they want to be together, there's no, they're not forced to be together. He had a snoring issue. They had their space. They had met on Planet of the Apes, and they've collaborated a lot over the years. And if you listen to the interviews, they've said that I think at their worst, when they were bickering and fighting a lot, was during the making of Sweeney Todd, and that's when she fell pregnant the second time. Mm. And the sad thing about this is there has been talk of him cheating on her in the past. There was even a photo last year of a woman that was put to bed, and I think she basically said that she felt he was having a midlife crisis. She was giving him the space to sort of come back and find his senses, and clearly that actually hasn't happened. And that's the sad reality of many relationships, isn't it?
Well, I just wish that we could work out in relationships an affair is probably a symptom of things not going too well, and that's when we sit down and talk about, hey, should we still be together? And I just think that sometimes we focus on all the hatred and all the nastiness, and I wish we'd sometimes focus on the good things. But, Joe, can I just tell you, thank you very much, and you get back to your caftan and
G&T. My champagne overlooking the mosaic tiles,
Indeed. Hey, thank you very much, Joe. It's fantastic to speak to you. But that's Joe Casamento. She's the entertainment guru currently up in Queensland enjoying Versace-ness. But the serious side of this is, why do relationships have to end in hatred? Why can't we just sort of end and say, look, we had some good times, off we go? Why do we always have to find a bad thing? And moreover, why do we have to scapegoat this other person, which sometimes might not even know that the person was married? We're going to take a break, come back with more after this. In the opener for the show, I talked about how men in offices wear ties, and I wonder why. I'll just interrupt that because on the line I have Bernie. Hello, Bernie. Did you want to make a comment about driver training?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've tried many times before with Neil Mitchell and whatever, but you can't get through. And I'm happy to talk to you anyway. When an accident comes up, never ever do you ever hear from the police, RACV, NRMA, TAC, about let's improve our driver training.
Mm.
You never hear it. And I'll tell you another one, just a quick statistic, high statistics. They say that about 15% of the accidents, or 20%, involve 18 to 22s.
Mm.
Therefore, the rest of the accidents involve the other 80 or 85%.
Mm. Mm.
The 80 to 85% form the group who take the kids for the 120 hours.
That's true.
Therefore, you're perpetuating the problem.
So maybe we need to. I mean, I know when my daughter was learning to get her license, I actually made her go and have proper lessons. I didn't want to be the one to teach her. I wanted someone who knew what they were doing to teach her.
Yeah.
Bernie, I think you're right, and I know Neil is a great supporter of driver training.
Well, he may be, but he can't discuss it.
Oh,
and I would like to talk to him about it in depth.
Sure.
For example, he gets off the tram and then. But I'll give you an example. I did the Mercedes-Benz driver training at Sandown Park.
Yep.
That was not, and I will challenge Mercedes on this, that was not driver training. that was a demonstration of Mercedes vehicles.
There are driver training. I know that they advertise on this station too, driver training services. And I must say, I once got my CAMS license, and I did training down at Sandown. And while you may say, well, that's training for the Grand Prix, and I drove in the Celebrity Grand Prix, what we learned as far as how to brake, how to corner, and how to deal with the wet, I couldn't agree with you more, Bernie, that I think we need more training on that, and I think people should take it upon themselves. I know my father, I think he was at the age of 85, decided, well, if I'm going to keep driving a car, I better go and do it. So he went and did driver training, and it really helped his confidence enormously. So, look, thank you very much for your call, Bernie. Appreciate it, and we listen to you, and you can. I'm sure if you write to Neil, he'll respond. We are hearing some reports, by the way, that objects resembling emergency slides in a plane door have been seen in the search for the missing AirAsia flight. However, coming back on our expert earlier, things can resemble all sorts of things. So we'll find out. More to come. And, Rebecca, hello.
Hi, Dr. Sally. You're mentioning about men having to wear ties in the office.
Indeed.
But I would like to know why girls from the age of buds to year 7 to year 12 have to wear skirts.
Do you know what, Rebecca? That reminds me. The school I went to, which was St. Leonard's College in Brighton, we were on the front page, I remember, I think it was the Herald Sun, because they let girls wear pants. So obviously there are some schools that did it, but that was like in 1970-something or other. So, yes, I agree with you. Girls shouldn't have to wear skirts. Coming up after the break, we're going to have Steve Clawson in the US and Malcolm Stewart in the UK, and we are going to talk a bit more about why men wear ties still. I don't know. I'll tell you what. It's amazing. We'll be back after. Now for our regular cross to the UK, Malcolm Stewart in London for Brighton Land Rover. Step into a new Freelander TD4 from 49900, drive away. Malcolm, good afternoon. I believe there's been a positive diagnosis of Ebola.
Yes, this is a healthcare worker. We don't know whether she's a doctor or a nurse, but she's just returned from Sierra Leone, and she felt ill, in fact, overnight after her flight that involved a change of planes in London to Glasgow, and she's been taken to a specialist hospital in Glasgow, the Gart Naval Hospital, an isolation unit there, and she's going to be transferred down to London to the Royal Free Hospital as soon as possible in an air ambulance. That was the hospital that treated William Poley, the other British healthcare worker, who was brought back to this country after actually developing Ebola in Sierra Leone. So he was specially protected, but, there is some concern that this woman, healthcare worker, she transferred planes from Sierra Leone to London via Casablanca and then took the British Airways shuttle from Heathrow Airport to Glasgow on Sunday night. So people who were on those flights, which the numbers have been given, who are feeling ill, are advised, of course, to contact medical specialists as soon as possible. So some concern there, and there's always this fear when our volunteers started to go out to that area, but the Save the Children Fund, for which this woman worked, say that they've just got to carry on with the work there, but they are being attempting to be extremely careful about staff who return, although obviously in this particular case, she slipped through the net.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Malcolm. I believe just on that one, that my understanding of Ebola is it isn't that easy to contract, and people usually have to have actual contact with body fluids in order to for contraction, not just walking past someone in the corridor. But now let's wing away across to the US and Steve Clawson for Brighton Land Rover Authorised Service, New Street, Brighton. Good afternoon, Steve.
And good afternoon, Sally. We're talking about a story from California today. The Fort Bragg School District in California today reversed a decision to prohibit T-shirts reading "I Can't Breathe" from being worn by students participating in a high school basketball tournament. As you know, the phrase "I can't breathe" were the last words spoken by New Yorker Eric Garner, who died after being put in a police chokehold a few months ago. His death has sparked nationwide protest. Well, Mendocino High School students are now allowed to wear the T-shirts during warm-ups for the tournament as long as they don't cause any problems. Also, fans can wear the T-shirts, and several did today as the tournament got underway. An attorney for the school district said officials had wanted to avoid a costly legal battle. That's the reason for the decision today. He says the district was simply trying to prevent a disruption in the community, which is still in mourning following the loss of a sheriff's deputy who was killed in line of duty earlier this year. Now, had the school board not reversed its decision today, a First Amendment lawyer who represents one of the players, she was prepared to file a motion in federal court arguing that the ban violated free speech rights. The T-shirts have become very popular here in the country. Several National Basketball Association players, such as LeBron James and Derrick Rose, well, they've been seen wearing the T-shirts during warm-ups, and the NBA has not done anything about it at all.
Mm. Look, I think I can see the point, and I think that it's really good that they've changed their mind. I mean, students feel very strongly about these things. To tell them they can't wear the T-shirts would just make it worse, I would have thought. So
yeah, it sure did.
No, I saw that footage of that just horrendous. The horrendous footage of that gentleman. And look, I mean, the world we live in at the moment, we need positive things, and I can understand a school being worried that it was going to make more trouble. But really, we've got to allow people to have their say, especially in these sort of issues. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a new teaching method to improve learning, and this is being trialled. And we're going to talk about the use of, I suppose, what are usually scientific medical techniques in schools. And also, I'd like to hear from whether you know anything about home tattoo kits. Has anyone you know got one of these? What do you think? It's a good idea? I'd love to hear from you. We are listening to 3AW to Drive, and this is Melbourne's own 3AW 693. See you after news. We're here with you till 6, and give us a call, 96900 693. Now, there was an earlier report about some items that may have been from the missing Air Asia flight. On the line is Michael Bachelard, the Fairfax Indonesia correspondent. Michael, what's the word on this?
The word is that there's about 10 large objects and many other smaller objects that may have been spotted near Pangkalanbun, which was quite close actually to the area where the aircraft lost contact with the air traffic control on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. They are said to resemble a slide and a door of an aircraft, but at this stage the helicopter that's there is hovering above it at about 200 feet and can't really make out very clearly what the objects are. We've just found out that another helicopter is on the way and may be able to get in a little closer, but and there are some ships on the way too, but that may be another hour. We here at the media centre in the Surabaya airport have been jumping at shadows now for 2 days.
Yeah.
We hope this is not another shadow, but there is always that possibility.
Indeed, and look, we just want closure for these people, Michael, I'm sure. And look, thank you very much for your time. I know you're very busy, and we do appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. That was Michael Bachelard, the Fairfax Indonesia correspondent. And as we heard earlier from our expert, that the trouble is that many things can resemble many things, but, you know, if we could just get closure for those people, it would be fantastic. Now, when I say the word double-blind crossover study, it's a familiar term to me. It may not be for you, and it's certainly probably not one that's familiar to the education department, but let's take a scientific approach to education, and that's exactly what my next guest has done. It's Dr. Sharon Goldfeld, who's from the Royal Children's Hospital Centre for Community Child Health. This is a trial with a bit of a difference, Sharon. What are you doing?
Good afternoon. Yes. Well, we're doing a cluster randomised control trial. So what does that mean? It means that we take a group of schools, and in this case both a combination of Catholic and government schools, and we randomly assign the schools to either getting the intervention, in inverted commas, or just doing business as usual. And within each of those schools, we then randomly choose a classroom to focus on following up the children. So we call that a cluster randomised controlled trial, which we see in a number of health-based trials, but almost never in education.
Mm. So what's usually in a health-based trial, there's a hypothesis and we want to try and prove it or disprove it. Is there a hypothesis in this case?
Of course. So the hypothesis is threefold. The first thing is we hypothesise that we can change what teachers know. The second is that by changing what teachers know, we can change what teachers do. And the third element is by changing what teachers do, we change outcomes for children. And in this case, we're particularly focusing on oral language and social and emotional well-being as being the two outcomes.
And what's the sort of end point? What sort of outcomes are you hoping for?
So we're doing two sets of outcomes. The final outcome is children's year 3 reading and literacy results on NAPLAN. but the interim results are focusing on children's reading and oral language at the end of grade one, which is the end of the second year of the intervention.
And is this because of literacy rates that we want to see what works? Is it because literacy rates are a problem?
It's a combination of things. I think there's an emerging evidence now that oral language is really a much stronger precursor for literacy than was previously thought, and that there are particular elements of oral language that are important to be thought about in the classroom setting and perhaps have been a bit underdone in traditional educational paradigms. And so this particular intervention focuses on a professional learning package, which is four face-to-face days with teachers from all of the intervention schools. And when I say teachers, I mean all of the in Victoria prep, so the first year of school, so prep and grade one teachers across the whole school. So it's trying to change the way the schools do the teaching in the classroom.
Now, one of the things with all medical and scientific studies is they have to go through an ethics committee, because ethics committees have to think about the effect that that a certain study may have on people. Has there been ethics committee involvement in this study? I mean, I would imagine, given that you're talking about children's education, you'd need to.
Absolutely. So we do have ethics from Monash University, and we also have permission from both the Catholic and government sectors. They don't have ethics committees, but they do review all of the applications.
And what about the variability? We also look for, you know, things that may cause compounding and confounding biases and things like that. What about the fact that you can't absolutely say that that the teachers are all exactly the same? I mean, like when you're giving someone a medication, you say, well, this is your medication, this is yours. But you've got teachers who may be more vibrant or may be more reserved. How do you get around that?
Well, this is the beauty of a randomised controlled trial. With a randomised controlled trial, you're assuming, and we obviously do some measures to try and make sure that this is the case, that you've randomly allocated all of the vibrant teachers equally to the intervention arm and to the control arm.
Mm.
And that's the beauty of doing this sort of methodology, that you eliminate a lot of those biases by randomisation.
Indeed. And look, it's interesting to note that what have they done to now? Have they just sort of thought, oh, this seems to work, oh, that's a good idea? Is this the you said earlier this is the first time they've really done something like this.
Yes, and I think it's there's a big push from the UK with a very big endowment fund there doing more randomised controlled trials. I don't think it's a methodology that's been particularly used in education. There's been a lot of before and after trials, a lot of case practice and good practice study, but this sort of methodology hasn't really been used, and I think there's a great opportunity here, given the number of schools we have and the ability to be able to test some of these practices a little more rigorously.
Absolutely. I think it's I'm just, of course, quite astounded to think that they hadn't done it, but we should. This is why we all need to share information across all, I suppose, areas of education, teaching, everything. So, Sharon, look, well done on what you're doing. When does the study finish up? About 5 years from now?
Yeah, about 4 years from now.
Oh, we'll look forward to speaking to you then.
All right, then.
Thanks very much. That's Dr. Sharon Goldfeld. She's from the Royal Children's Hospital Centre for Community Child Health. And what they're doing is they're doing a scientific study of education in schools. And maybe if you've got a child starting school next year, they may be part of it. Looking to find the scientific evidence for what type of teaching works best. It's a no-brainer when it comes to that sort of thing from my perspective. 96900693, what do you think about your child being involved in a trial in a school of reading and testing? Obviously, as Sharon has said, it's been through ethics committees, it's been approved, but I'd be interested in your thoughts. 96900693131332. Don't forget, word on the street, are you somewhere where something's happening? I'd like to hear from you. $200 pancake parlour voucher. After the break, we're going to talk about those home tattooing kits and what the dangers might be. It's 5:15. Love to hear your calls, 96900693, on any of the topics that we've talked about today, or maybe this one. You know, I said earlier I don't like being the thought police. As a doctor, I want to give the public health message, but I don't want to tell you what to do. But I do want to tell you about this. And this is an article from the Mail Online, Charlie Langston, with regard to a craze that's happening overseas about people getting DIY, do-it-yourself, tattoo kits. This is really concerning, and I think for very good reason. And a person who I'm sure can tell us the very good reason on the line is Melanie Eagle, the CEO of Hepatitis Victoria. Are you aware of these home tattoo kits, Melanie?
No, I'm not, Sally. It's been brought to my attention through you.
Yeah, well, I'm worried about it.
But I am aware that generally people can take risks like this, and it's the kind of type of year that people might be, time of year, sorry, that people might be doing just exactly this type of thing. It's time to party. It's nearly New Year's Eve, a bit of a lark out in summer, and then sometimes we think of the consequences of our behaviour later on.
Well, it's not only the communicable disease side of it, which I'll get you to elucidate in a minute, but also they're saying in America that they're not sure about the toxic nature of the inks and people would be putting or unclean needles. How do we know the needles that are coming in this are actually clean? So, I mean, there's quite a range of risks.
Yes, I was surprised on exactly the same lines as you're thinking too, that, you know, yes, perhaps you and I and some of the readers are aware that if you share needles, you can be sharing blood contaminants, and hepatitis is the angle that I guess I'm aware of through my involvement in Hepatitis Victoria. But if you are buying something from a company that you don't know about that hasn't had to pass through regulations and it just comes to you in the mail, and we're already reading now that at times, exactly as you say, they can be unsterile and have contaminants in the ink, you really don't know what you're putting in your body. And that is not the same as going out, thinking about it, planning it, and going to a registered tattooist and doing it safely.
And I suppose this is exactly right. We've got some very, very stringent laws about how tattoo parlours behave and having their autoclaves and sterilisation equipment. And you just, to think that someone could just go online and buy this imported and bingo, it's just it's scary.
Yes, and it does get around those requirements as well about age. And I like your opening that, you know, we don't want to sound like B or B even, the thought police. We know people will, you know, act in certain ways, and I can remember dim, dark past. You know, I might have too before the slipper period of life took over. We understand people do these things, but there are reasons why there are those rules, why there are age requirements before people are allowed to have certain types of, you know, piercings. And it's because you can make rash decisions, and being able to order things at home and get around some of those regulations is concerning.
Indeed. Look, can you also walk us through? I mean, I'm a hep hero, and can we talk a little? Yeah, we do. But I want you to tell us a little bit about hepatitis in Victoria and the problems that we've got at the moment.
Sure. So, 2% of the population have already live with hepatitis B or C, which is viral hepatitis that can lead to liver cancer or death at its worst. So, you know, it's a very serious condition if it's already not prevented, and so you've got it, and if it's not, then treated. Now, hepatitis C is the one that's more closely linked to this type of behaviour because it does come from sharing of needles usually. In the past, that's been standard injecting of drugs, but more recently, we've seen quite a lot of use of body piercing and tattooing also leading to hepatitis C.
And Melanie, also there are people who get hepatitis C through various other medical reasons from times before we really understood it. And I think one of the problems that I learned of with the when we were doing the campaign of the Hep C, the Hep Hero, was the stigma associated that people think if you've got Hep C, you must have, you know, shot up drugs or something. And we've got to get away from that. Melanie, look,
Oh, well, also there's, you know, you might have gone overseas and you might have been in your holiday to Bali or Thailand and, and got a little tattoo yourself. Or you might have had your toes clipped in an unsafe kind of... It can happen any way.
Or your ears pierced or your nose pierced. Yeah. Or, you know, I think if you're going to do piercing or you're going to do body art, do it in Australia where we have the regulations. That'd probably be the take-home message. Melanie Eagle, thank you very much for the fabulous work that you do at Hepatitis Victoria. I really appreciate your time.
Good on you.
Bye-bye then.
Thank you.
As I said, that's Melanie Eagle. She's the CEO of Hepatitis Victoria. It's really easy. Do not go and get these online. If you see them, don't go and get these online DIY tattoo things. Just not safe. Now, I mentioned earlier, I started off the hour actually saying that I wanted to talk about why men wear ties. And, of course, politicians, we used to be able to tell who was who in the zoo because they wore a red tie or a blue tie. Now they don't wear ties at all. I mean, Daniel Andrews, when he did his victory speech, he didn't have a tie on at all. So to really talk about this very serious topic, Cindy Newstead is a personal stylist for Chadston. Cindy, why don't men move into the 21st century?
Hi, Sally. Look, I think it's just something that's been coming in for a long time now. If you look at it, traditionally, men have been wearing ties for, you know, over 100 years.
I
know. So I just think that, look, it's nice to think that what the politician has to say is actually more important than what he wears, but unfortunately, we're living in an era where we're judged very, very quickly on our appearance.
Oh, and I think Julia Gillard was a victim of that. And
absolutely.
I think some of the comments that were made about her attire and her anatomy were just so inappropriate.
Look, they were, but as I said, this is something that I know that I deal with every day, and that is that, you know, when you've got someone who is in a position of authority and leadership, they need to stand out for the right reasons. We don't want them to blend in.
Exactly. Well, I must say, I did like Julia Gillard had a particularly nice top. It was a white top and it tied at the front. The trouble is she wore it so often that when I went in to see it in a shop, I thought, I can't buy that.
Do you know what? I take a lot of women shopping and many, many women would say, oh, no, don't put me near that. That's what Julia Gillard wears. No.
And that's the risk, isn't it? That's the risk for the retailer.
It really is a risk, unfortunately. But I just think, you know, it is important that someone who's got an authority, a position of authority, they do need to stand out. Mm. And that way that shows leadership. I don't think it necessarily makes them appear untouchable. If we look at Daniel, for example, you know, he wore the blazer, he wore a check shirt, beautiful shoes, great quality jeans. He did look fabulous.
Why doesn't he do it now? He's gone back to the tie and the shirt and everything like that.
Well, that's because everyone's giving him a hard time.
Oh.
You can sit on the fence with this two different ways. I can look at the positive, the form, and I can look at the against it. I'm a little bit old-fashioned. I take people shopping and, of course, I have to help people buy ties every day, but it is changing.
Do you know what's really interesting, though, Cindy? I find I love shopping. I buy shoes, I buy clothes, but I can't buy ties for men. I buy really bad ties, they say. So is there an art to buying ties?
I don't think so. I think it's just it comes down to personality with a lot of guys, and then it's also getting something. Well, it is personality.
What do you think the bow tie says?
Beg your pardon?
What do you think the bow tie says?
Well, do you know what? It's a funny thing. We have a lot of children, and Christmas Eve we had two guys turn up in a bow tie out of fun, and they look fantastic.
Oh.
I'm not a big advocate for it, to be honest with you, but
it's mandatory. It's mandatory uniform for gynecologists. There you go. We won't go into that, Cindy. I must say though that I tell you someone who I think is just a really stylish politician. That's Julie Bishop. She looks fantastic lately.
She does, and I think that she's got some good advice. It could be a bit of personal taste in there as well, but it does shine through. And like I say, what happened to Julia, it is unfortunate, but a lot of the time she did not look fantastic, and so therefore she got picked on.
Yeah, and I suppose the men get picked on too if they don't dress. Maybe that's why they wear a black suit and a tie, because it's a black suit and a tie. In fact, what didn't Carl Stefanovic or something wear the same suit for a week or something and no one said anything? Something like that on TV, I don't know.
Look, it wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, I was thinking about this a little earlier, and I just think of someone like George Clooney. If you think
he couldn't do anything wrong, sorry.
No, all right, maybe not. But let's just talk about George for 1 second. You think about him wearing a white tux shirt and just a dark navy or an ink suit and no tie. And we all went crazy over it.
And it's still credible.
Beg your pardon?
And he's still credible like that.
He is, and that's a theme. That's something that's passed on. People have cottoned on to that.
Yeah. Well, what about budgie smugglers? Have we got there yet? I mean, the Prime Minister was budgie
smugglers. Oh, no. My husband was a lifeguard and in the surf club many, many years ago, and he still is a fan of them. I'm not.
Oh, no.
No,
I'm not. Happy. Maybe if we have to choose between budgie smugglers and a certain tie, let's go with a certain tie, I think.
Absolutely. Something just funny happened. I don't know if I've got time to tell you, but my 80-year-old father, I put him on a plane this morning to fly back to Queensland, and he got VIP service. They thought he was a VIP. Do you know why? Because he's 80 years of age and he was wearing a tie and a blazer.
There you go. It works. Yeah, I must admit, I like to get my old dad into his college tie and his tuxedo. What do you call it? Reefer jacket. That's the one, the reefer jacket. Cindy, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
It looks like the shirt and tie are here to stay, but I wish
I hope so.
I don't. I'd like them to go. Thanks very much, Cindy. It was great to speak to you. That's Cindy Newstead, who's a personal stylist for Chadstone. And speaking of shirts and tie, he's sitting opposite me, tieless. But he's still credible. Tony Tardio.
Thank you, Sally. Good afternoon again. There are reports that objects resembling an emergency slide and a plane door have been spotted in the search for the missing AirAsia flight. Other objects, including a life raft, life jackets and long orange tubes, have also been seen. They were about 10 kilometres from the location the plane was last captured by radar. An elderly man and a woman have been airlifted to hospital after being trapped for some time following a collision between a car and a bus at Turidon this afternoon. The search for an Australian man reported missing while climbing New Zealand's tallest mountain isn't likely to resume until New Year's Day. And in sport, Australia has grabbed a fifth wicket with India 5 for 142 in the Boxing Day Test match at the MCG. The Australians, who declared at lunch, have a further 17 overs to bowl the Indians out. Sally, we'll have those stories in the news at 6.
Look forward to it, Tony. Thank you very much. And we'll see you tomorrow from my perspective. As I said, don't forget, word on the street, 96900 693. There is a pancake parlour voucher in the offing for you, $200 worth if you want to. Coming up after the break, I'm going to be speaking to my good friend Todd Harper, who is the CEO of the Cancer Council, used to be the CEO of VicHealth, and before that, Director of Quit Victoria. We'll be talking to him about good messages. Back after this.
3AW traffic. Get the power of Tyre Power's summer scorcher sale.
Still clearing an accident in research. It's on Main Road, not far from Eltham College in Maribyrnong, outside High Point Shopping Centre there on Rosamond Road. Up in Red Hill, a tree has fallen on a car, forcing the closure of Arthur's Seat Road near the Mornington-Flinders Road intersection there. And in Turidon, delays remain after a couple of very nasty accidents on the South Gippsland Highway just near the river crossing. Got some works continuing, affecting northbound traffic on Springvale Road in Springvale at St James Avenue. But the freeway's all in excellent shape. In fact, it's standard travel times across the board. And that's 3AW traffic. The Big W sale is on now with huge savings across the store, like 50% off Tefal fry pans, plus many more offers at Big W today. I'm Chris Miller.
This is Drive with Sally Coburn.
96900 693 1313 32 is the number to call. Love to hear from you on any of the topics on selfies. Yeah, I'd love to hear from about that. The tattoo kits. We're also talking about whether men should still wear ties. And maybe my next guest, I'll ask him that question too. Earlier on the show, we talked about a campaign that's come out of the Alfred Hospital, which is saying that doctors have a responsibility to talk more often and really strongly to patients about smoking. I sort of said that while I agree with the no question about the health message, I wonder whether we sometimes alienate people and we have to choose our campaigns very carefully, that we don't actually send people running in the other direction. And on the line is a man who I usually see wearing a tie, and that's Todd Harper. And the reason Todd is perfect for this comment is he's the current CEO of the Cancer Council of Victoria. He's a former CEO of VicHealth, and he's also a former executive director of Quit Victoria. If there's one thing Todd knows, it's how to do a campaign. Hello, Todd.
Hi, Sally. How are you?
Very, very well, thank you. Now, look, I'm just sort of thinking, are there do's and don'ts in campaigns? Do we sometimes, do they backfire?
Yeah, and look, it's important with campaigns to, as much as possible, to test for that. So if you're looking at, for example, a quit smoking campaign, what you'll do in the testing is look for any possibilities about where the campaign could backfire and not be taken up by the people that you're aiming to communicate to. So that's always part of the planning process that goes with good campaign.
Well, one of the things that worried me when I heard about this one was that the way it was being interpreted in the media was GPs must tell patients to stop smoking. And we've had a few calls today who've agreed that I don't want my doctor to constantly tell me to stop smoking. I'll go elsewhere if they say that. And one person who even said that their doctor refused to give them a medical certificate because they were smoking. And that's not the message, obviously, that this campaign is trying to get across. And I know it's not your campaign.
Yeah, sure. But I think it's. I think the key thing here is trust, and there needs to be a strong relationship of trust between the GP and the patient. And I think it is important, vital, in fact, for that trust to be there. But it's, and part of that trust, I think, is that if the doctor should be talking to the person about smoking. I agree that you don't want to alienate the patient. But doctors are in a terrific position because of the respect that they have with patients and in the broader community to at least start the conversation. It doesn't need to be one that is finger-wagging, because in most cases, the smoker actually doesn't want to be smoking. Exactly. They've tried to quit before. What they need is support and assistance to do that.
So, Todd, with your career spanning, you know, Quit and Vic Health and Cancer Cattle, what do you think's one of the most successful campaigns for preventive health issues?
I don't think there's any doubt that the ones that we've seen, for example, with the Quit campaign, I think has been incredibly successful. We've also seen that's in fact, those campaigns are now used around the world because of their effectiveness. Similarly with the TAC and road safety, the fact that we have such a very low road toll now, I think, is ample evidence of that. And also the workplace health and safety campaigns and the SunSmart campaign, I think, are examples of where we've used communications really effectively, but we haven't fallen into the trap of thinking all we have to do is tell people about the harms and what they need to do and we've done our job. In fact, what you need in these places with these campaigns are supportive elements like smoke-free laws or speeding messages. We need requirements around workplace health and safety. All of these things help to support those communication campaigns so the communication campaigns aren't doing it on their own.
You mentioned the TAC campaigns about road trauma. I was speaking to a specialist trauma surgeon earlier on about the road toll, and my point was that we concentrate on death, but frankly the morbidity associated with road accidents, I don't think we've addressed that well enough in road safety campaigns.
It's very powerful. I know that in work that we've done previously with a Quit campaign, and so I'm sure it's been looked at in other areas like road safety as well, is that people often do know that that these things, speeding and drink driving and smoking, are harmful and could cause death. But for many people, what is they don't have as much understanding about is the how these diseases or accidents can be incredibly disabling, change your life immediately and permanently and change the lives of those around you. And I think it is an element that can be very powerful in communicating to people because I don't think it is as well understood as death would be from accidents and from smoking.
Todd, there's a campaign that's currently being played on 3RW with Neil Mitchell voicing the commercial about men and skin cancer and older men getting skin cancer. And the only thing that dawned on me about listening to that is the message that we want to get across that they can prevent skin cancer? Because aren't I right that really the damage for those men who are now in their 40s and 50s, while we want them to change their ways, the damage was done many, many years ago?
A lot of the cases it is, that's right, because this is the generation that wasn't brought up with the SunSmart messages. So a lot of the times it's about certainly not exacerbating any of the harms that have done, being vigilant around any changes in your skin, having regular skin checks, those sorts of things. So anything that starts a conversation with that group about skin cancer, preventing skin cancer, detecting it early, I think is really vital because they're the ones, as I said, haven't had the benefit of those many years now of awareness campaigns. And so in that group, we still see very high rates of skin cancer.
Do you know that the thing that I am noticing out there, and this is maybe, I think, a message we could get across to maybe grandparents and hopefully new parents, the number of people I see wheeling their pusher with their child facing straight ahead of them into the sun and totally not being protected from the sun. And if people had just turned the pusher around and pushed them with them facing them, they may actually save them from those sun's rays.
Look, I think it's a good point that you make. And one of the things that we have seen now is a real change in attitudes. I still am amazed to see the level of awareness that's in our primary schools, for example, that you don't see kids at primary school these days without their SunSmart gear. And I think that's a very powerful message about how giving people the information in a way that they can understand at a time when they're ready to receive it. And if you sustain that over time, we see terrific results in changing people's behaviour for the better.
So with New Year's coming up tomorrow, people are obviously going to be making their resolutions. And are there any anti-cancer resolutions they should be making?
Well, certainly the most important one that people can do is quit smoking. There's absolutely no doubt about that. With two out of every three long-term smokers dying, there's no better thing that you can do to protect and promote your health. So if people do
nothing else, then that would be a terrific way to start, and to call a quit line on 137848 would be a great way to start a healthier new year.
Indeed. And I have to say congratulations to the Cancer Council for their fabulous work. And Doreen Ackerman, I just think, is one of our living treasures, Doreen being the woman who just was responsible for that beautiful cancer line. And Todd, look, lovely to speak to you, and
you too, Sally.
To speak to you, and good luck with the new year. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too, Sally.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye then.
Thanks a lot.
That's Todd Harper, who is the CEO of the Cancer Council of Victoria, also before that the CEO of VicHealth, and before that Executive Director of the Quit Victoria, a man who has spent his life all about prevention, preventive health, and he's very good at it. 96900 693 is the number. We're going to be talking to an expat who's listening to us right now, very shortly, back after this. 900 693 is the number if you'd like to be part of the show. Tragic death of a 17-year-old West Australian man, Jay Musket, yesterday, killed by a shark. And the Department of Fisheries is currently in Albany looking for the shark. And the Sea Shepherd, which is a marine conservation ship in WA, has also travelled to Albany. On the line is Jeff Hansen, the Managing Director of the Sea Shepherd Australia. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Sally. Thanks for having us on your show.
Well, thank you for the work you do. Now, your people are currently looking for the shark?
We're just stationed there near the fisheries, guys. Basically there to observe what's going on, and if they do happen to catch an IUC and Red List of Protected Species, we'll be getting those images and footage to showcase to the world, who are really condemning what the West Australian government, their attitude towards sharks at the moment. But I must say our hearts really go out to Jay Musket's family, because he seems like a real lover of the ocean and a real lover of life. So
absolutely,
it's a real tragedy.
Now, I believe the shark may have a spear in its mouth at the moment.
Yeah, it seems that Jay was spearfishing with a mate. The shark went over his mate, bumped his mate, and then grabbed Jay's leg, it looks like. And turned around and came around and, it went for the other guy, but he shot a spear gun in his mouth and it took off.
So it may be, I mean, obviously sharks feel pain, I suppose. It may be that would make it more aggressive, or we don't know?
Oh, I think it would just leave the vicinity. We really don't know a huge amount about these animals. That's the thing, they're only down to around 700 breeding individuals in that part of Australia. So we're dealing with a species still coming back.
So with the species that is it endangered? Is it presumed endangered? Do you have to have authority to kill the shark, or is that something that is what's on the cards?
Basically, the federal environment minister needs to grant an exemption to kill it. So it's an exemption from the EPBC Act, the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act of Australia. And so Greg Hunt has given them an exemption to kill this shark if they catch it.
Does that actually achieve anything? I mean, other than, do they ask the family if that's what they want? Or?
I don't believe so. I think it's really a case of the West Australian Fisheries Department, just straight out. They make that decision. In terms of does it achieve anything, well, the answer is no. The Hawaii tried culling sharks for 18 years, and it made no difference to their shark-related incidents there. We knew that this shark was in the vicinity. People knew about it. I think we should go back to basics, where we don't have areas like this that have communications where you can check on mobile apps and Twitter sites. We just go back to having signage. Jay was a member of the WA Undersea Albany group. It was a keen group of divers and spear fishermen, and a lot of them had seen whites in this particular spot and had sharks come up to them. In fact, one of them would even ridden the dorsal fin of a shark. So they know that they're there, they know the risk.
And we do know that it's a white pointer?
At this stage, that's what the Fisheries Department believe it is, but no one knows for sure.
Yeah, okay. So we obviously don't know how big it is either, I presume.
They're thinking around about the 4 metre mark, three and a half to 4 metre mark. So, a good size shark. Interesting.
So, Jeff, when will the Sea Shepherd step in? You say you're alongside fisheries at the moment, but what's your role?
Well, unfortunately, we have an exclusion zone around the area, and Sea Shepherd don't break laws. We uphold them. So, we're down in Antarctica at the moment pursuing the thunder, and we've just pulled up 25 kilometres of illegal gillnet in the pristine Antarctic environment. And we've got the Interpol wanted thunder in pursuit now. So we won't be breaking laws. We'll abide by the fisheries, those boundaries.
So what's the outcome you hope for?
I hope the shark just swims away. I'd like to see that the WA government switch towards, instead of using drum lines and nets, which are being used around Australia from the 1950s and earlier, we move to things from 2014 that can actually help save lives, because we know scientifically and through past tests, killing sharks does not work. It doesn't help anyone.
I can't see the point, and I think that, I agree with you. Thank you very much for your time, Jeff. Really appreciate it. Good luck with that one.
Thanks for having us on your show, Sally.
Bye, Jeff. That's Jeff Hansen, the Managing Director of the Sea Shepherd Australia. A tragic, tragic thing to happen to Jay Muscat, there's no question, and his family, but I just don't see what killing the shark actually achieves. On the line, Marcel, hello.
Hello, Dr. Sally. I just want to wish you a happy and prosperous New Year.
And you too.
And we enjoy always your program.
You're not
just a general practitioner, but also you have a lovely voice.
I love
on the radio.
I love your voice, Marcel, with your beautiful accent.
Thank you.
It's
so
gorgeous.
I want to tell you about my son.
Yes?
Since he was 7 years old, he always wear tie and suit.
Oh, the darling little
And
suit.
You know what, Sally? He chews the toys and the suit.
And how old is he now, Marcel?
He's over 40.
And is he still wearing a suit and tie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
he's
what
a very handsome man.
Handsome, dapper man. Oh, we love
it.
Yeah,
he always wear from... He used to buy first suit from France.
Oh.
But when you get married, it's a different story.
Marcel, thank you for calling in, and your son sounds like a real hunk. Thank you very much. We're going to take a break and come back with more after this. What's been really lovely about doing this fill-in drive program is the number of people who come out of the woodwork who I haven't heard from for ages, and they appear on Twitter and they send me texts and they go, "Wow, there you are." One of those people who just appeared on Twitter is also known to you, and she is the fabulous Jenny Chapman. And Jenny is actually an expat now living in Hong Kong, and she's, I love this, she's known as Jenny from the paddock. Jenny from the paddock in Hong Kong. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Sally.
Hey,
how are you?
You just popped up on Twitter. It was fantastic. And you're living in Hong Kong, and what are you doing over there?
Well, I've been here for 22 years now.
Oh, is that long?
that long. And I do the horse racing commentary, so I'm the one in the paddock who tells you which horses look good or bad, and then you can decide if you want to have a bet or not.
Because you have actually been involved in the spring racing carnival over here as well in the past.
Yes, I did the Spring Racing Carnival for Channel 10 for many years and really enjoyed that. And I've sort of been up here for a long time working for the Jockey Club as well. So it's been a long time, but time flies here in Hong Kong. It's a great place to live and absolutely enjoy it. And while I'm doing the form, I like to tune into 3AW.
Well, we just love to hear you listening to 3AW when you're over in Hong Kong. It's fantastic to have you on board. Jenny, great to speak to you. Thank you very much for speaking to us and for listening all the way from Hong Kong. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Hong Kong New Year, yay. That's Jenny Chapman, and you will have seen her on the television during the Spring Racing Carnival, a lovely woman, and now 22 years in Hong Kong. Now, it's been a packed show. We've learnt a lot of things. What have we learnt? Well, we've learnt that it's not the responsibility of GPs to actually make you stop smoking. We just want to help you along the way. It actually should be your decision. We should be more concerned about the amount of serious injuries on the roads, I believe, not just looking at the road toll in terms of deaths. Also, there's potential debris that that's popping up. We obviously have to wait to find out from the AirAsia flight QZ8501. We cross our fingers that there will be closure. We know about the 17-year-old who won the right to undergo a gender-changing surgery, and also that selfie sticks are so the best. I so love them. And also, I don't think we should be talking to people about having to take the pill to get the doll. Coming up, Shane McGuinness with Sports Today.